From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. It is Monday, September 17th, which is also known as Constitution Day, Luke. Did you know that?
You were always sitting at the front of the class if they forgot about the quiz, weren't you?
I just sit across from our editor, Tricia McKinney, who came up with this little nugget. Apparently, it's the brainchild of Senator Robert Byrd. And you know you got to pay attention to him after the smackdown that he gave to Michael Vick. You know,
yeah, he was there when they wrote the Constitution. He knows.
He may have been. Apparently today requires all schools and colleges receiving federal money to teach about the Constitution on or around today's date, anniversary of the adoption of the Constitution. So there, go school yourself.
We have got a lot of show for you today. 2 hours, in fact.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about what are being known now as the Gina Six. These are some African-American young men in Gina, Louisiana, who are accused of beating a young white man. But there's a lot more to the story, which we're going to get into.
Also, a fantastic time waster, Madomi.com. You know when you get sort of a melody stuck in your head and you want to know the words to a song? This new website may have the answer for you.
Yeah. Also, we're going to talk about Ariel Sharon. Yeah, that Ariel Sharon. The former Israeli prime minister is, as it turns out, still lingering sort of on life support. This is almost 2 years after he had this really devastating stroke. We wanted to get the latest on his medical condition and also find out sort of how this is playing in Israel or if folks there have forgotten about him.
And for those of you who listened to the show last Friday, remember this guy?
987,990.
Yeah, he spent 3 months counting to a million. Did it in front of a web camera. Well, we're going to get the guy on the phone, ask him why, and we'll find out if those numbers are still ringing in his head. We'll also get today's top stories from our newscaster, Rachel Martin, in just a moment. But first, here's the BPP's big story.
I'm pleased to announce my nomination of Judge Michael Mukasey to be the 81st Attorney General of the United States.
President Bush has nominated Michael Mukasey to be the next attorney general. You heard it right there. If confirmed by the Senate, he'll succeed Alberto Gonzalez, who officially stepped down on Friday.
Judge Mukasey is a 66-year-old former federal judge in New York who was appointed to the bench by President Reagan back in 1987. Before that, he served as a Manhattan prosecutor under then U.S. Attorney Rudy Giuliani. Here's Judge Mukasey speaking after the president this morning.
The department faces challenges vastly different from those it faced when I was an assistant U.S. attorney 35 years ago. But the principles that guide the department remain the same: to pursue justice by enforcing the law with unswerving fidelity to the Constitution.
Now, a little bit of background. In 1993, Judge Mukasey presided over the trial of Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. Mukasey sentenced him to life in prison for his involvement in the first World Trade Center bombing and other terrorist plots.
Judge Mukasey also ruled in the 2003 case of Jose Padilla. He ruled that Padilla was an enemy combatant, but he also kind of deviated from the administration by saying Padilla was entitled to access to his lawyers.
Now, if you thought former Solicitor General Ted Olson was the favorite for this job, well, he was last week until Democrats signaled Olson's confirmation process would get rough and tumble.
Right. On this very program, actually, we talked to a conservative blogger named Paul Mierengoff from Powerline, and he said that he wanted Olson to be the new attorney general. Apparently, the word came from Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid that Olson would face a very tough confirmation fight because Democrats think he's too partisan. Olson represented Bush in the Supreme Court battle over the contested 2000 election.
Now, Mukasey has gotten support from Democrats in the past, including New York Senator Chuck Schumer, who, of course, was a vocal critic of Alberto Gonzalez. Last night, Senator Schumer released a statement saying, quote, "While he is certainly conservative, Judge Mukasey seems to be the kind of nominee who would put rule of law first and show independence from the White House our most important criteria."
And most people take that vote of confidence by Chuck Schumer as an indication that Mukasey is going to face a pretty painless confirmation process. We'll watch that to see what happens. That, by the way, is today's BPP big story. Let's get the rest of the news now with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. An American private security firm has been kicked out of Iraq following a shooting in Baghdad in which 11 people were killed. An Interior Ministry spokesman said Blackwater security contractors opened fire yesterday against civilians in the western district of Baghdad after mortar rounds landed near their vehicles. 11 people were killed, including one policeman, and 13 wounded. The Iraqi government has withdrawn the company's license to work in the country and plans to prosecute those involved. Blackwater has been working in Iraq since the initial U.S. invasion. And if you remember, back in 2004, four Blackwater guards were brutally killed, their bodies burned and hung by insurgents in Fallujah. Those deaths sparked a massive U.S. military assault in which 27 Marines died. Authorities in Thailand have found the two flight data recorders that were on the plane that crashed yesterday on the island of Phuket, killing 90 people. The budget One2Go Airlines flight was carrying 124 passengers and 7 crew members from Bangkok to the resort island of Phuket when pilots tried to land the plane in heavy wind and rain. The plane skidded off the runway, rammed into a retaining wall, and was soon engulfed in flames. The president of the airline blamed the high-velocity winds for the crash. Thailand's transport minister said the plane's box data would be sent to the United States for analysis. And OJ's in the can. The juice is not on the loose. These are a couple of the newspaper headlines you might have seen today related to a reported armed robbery in a Las Vegas hotel last week. OJ Simpson was charged yesterday with 6 felonies in connection with the theft of sports memorabilia. Simpson and 5 other people are accused of storming into a room at the Palace Station Hotel Thursday night and confiscating memorabilia, including photographs and books signed by the former NFL star. Simpson has maintained that he was only retrieving items that had been stolen from him and that no guns were involved in what he called a self-organized sting operation. And actress Sally Field has already locked herself into award show history when she gave a rambling Oscar acceptance speech 22 years ago, waxing on about how much America liked her. And last night at the Emmy Awards, Field made awards history again. She won for Best Actress in her role as in the drama Brothers and Sisters, and Field was apparently censored during her acceptance speech when she used a swear word while voicing anti-war sentiments. According to the Associated Press, she said, quote, "If mothers ruled the world, there would be no blankety-blank wars in the first place." There were other bleeps as well. Early in the show, comedian Ray Romano and actress Katherine Heigl were both cut off when they apparently used some choice 4-letter words while speaking on stage. And amidst all the bleeping hubbub, there were some awards doled out. Of note, the long-running HBO series The Sopranos won Best Drama Series, and NBC show 30 Rock won Best Comedy Series. The news is always online at NPR.org. I'm Rachel Martin, Luke and Allison. Back to you.
Tina Fey had the best acceptance speech. She said, "I'd like to thank our dozens and dozens of viewers."
Because, but then I'm not supposed to say that about this show. But
30
it's funny
Rock
when she
is,
does it.
30 Rock is one of those shows that has got such critical acclaim, but not the best ratings right now.
It's just too beautiful to live, I think. It's one of my many favorite shows that will maybe not be around forever.
Oh, well, we can always watch it online and listen to us online as well. Thanks, Rachel Martin.
You bet.
The job of Attorney General is technically open as of today.
I got my application in.
Yeah, right. Aponte Gonzalez left the post on Friday after 2.5 years on the job, so to speak. Friday at the Justice Department, he spoke about his time as the AG.
My day began today, as it has almost always during the past 32 months, with an intelligence briefing on the efforts of our enemies. And as I depart, I wish that I could tell you that our work is done, that there are no threats, but I cannot. Our enemy is resourceful and determined, and I will wonder and worry when I am gone what is being said in those briefings.
Mr. Gonzalez leaves a Justice Department where almost every senior official has resigned or announced plans to depart this year. And according to the Washington Post, at least a quarter of the nation's U.S. attorneys are temporary appointees, which happened while Gonzalez was in charge. So it appears the man or woman who will be the 81st Attorney General will have a whole bunch to deal with. David Mark is a senior editor for Politico.com. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, okay, the president made the announcement just moments ago that Michael Mukasey from New York is his choice for a nominee. And he's getting a bipartisan thumbs up all the way around. You hear words like fair and independent, which are kind of code words, I'm guessing. Tell me 3 things that Mukasey's nomination signals.
Well, number one, President Bush realized he knew he had no choice in this matter. about his only other option was doing a recess appointment, which would never stand with Democrats. They would allow nothing else to get through. So the Bush administration realized they had to make some kind of consensus pick. Number two, this guy has been praised by Democrats of all people. Chuck Schumer, one of the leading critics of the Bush administration on judicial and other matters, says he likes the guy. He even suggested his name as a Supreme Court appointment. Number three, he has actually ruled against the Bush administration, at least in some measure. You referenced the Jose Padilla case earlier. While he sided with the Bush administration in naming Padilla an enemy combatant, he said he was entitled to legal counsel. That's a big departure from what Alberto Gonzalez would have said.
So, David, are you telling me the Senate confirmation hearings for this guy, they're going to be a yawn?
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think the Democrats are in any mood to give Bush a free ride at this point, but I don't think they'll end up blocking this guy.
All right, let's go back to the State Department and the Justice Department and the state of the Justice Department, which is what I was trying to get at. Is morale as low as has been reported?
It really seems to be. You have a lot of career prosecutors. These are not the folks that come in with the start of each administration and are brought in to carry out the priorities of the new president. These are people who were president after president. They feel like their cases have been turned upside down. Cases have been brought or not brought strictly because people involved are Republicans or Democrats. That's really what Mr. Mukasey has to work against and change that culture.
Are there any particular outstanding issues aside from the culture that Mr. Gonzalez leaves behind that could really be an issue for the incoming attorney general?
Well, there's certainly the issue of warrantless wiretapping. That's something Congress will be tackling in the next few weeks. But the administration, the Justice Department, has a lot of say in that. And as you reference also, there's a lot of U.S. attorneys' jobs to be filled in some pretty sensitive spots, too, replacing the one in Los Angeles, who the former one seems to have left under some strange circumstances. Plenty of others as well. A lot of very politically sensitive issues.
You know who Mukasey must lie in bed just angry at is O.J. Simpson. And the reason is because he presided, you know, Mukasey's big sort of shot was this trial of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh. That started the day before the O.J. trial started, and it got totally blown out of the water in terms of coverage. And now he gets, you know, nominated to be attorney general, and O.J. breaking into a Vegas hotel room is like on TV every second.
History repeats itself.
But let's
who could have thunk it?
That's an interesting question about Mukasey. Has he someone who has sought the limelight? I mean, is he someone, one of these judges, you know, you read about him in the paper all the time.
Right. No. And I think that's one of his most important attributes. He's not doing this as a career stepping stone. He's already been a federal judge for close to 20 years. He's in private law practice now, undoubtedly making lots of money. He can always go back to that, continue making lots of income. So he does this for a year, 14 months. It's a capstone to his career. And then he goes back to private life. So I think that's really important for the Bush administration. He's not going to be out there promoting himself. At least it's hoped he won't.
So Mukasey's getting all these accolades from all sides around. Alberto Gonzalez has got the wah-wah. He left the office. Everybody didn't let the door hit you
he's
on the way out.
He's going to be on the seventh floor with a cake by himself in the kitchen.
So just to be fair, what did Alberto Gonzalez accomplish in his 2.5 years as attorney general?
Well, his partisans, his defenders, will say that he actually accomplished a fair amount, including some progress on the warrantless wiretapping. There was some agreement with Congress, at least temporarily, to allow this if there was some kind of judicial oversight. He also went after online predators a lot, and while this gets mocked in the news, it is a serious issue, and he put prosecutorial resources very much in that area. So I think he will have some accomplishments. No doubt, though, he will not be going down as one of the great attorney generals in American history.
All right. I'm a lady who likes timelines. Tell me what's next.
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee, run by Democrats, of course, will probably look to be holding hearings on this in the next week or two. Democrats don't get a lot of political benefit by dragging this out. The biggest open question for these confirmation hearings is whether they're going to try and force Mukasey to pledge that he will appoint some kind of prosecutor or somebody to look into Gonzalez's conduct in office. I suspect they won't, but there has been some chatter about that.
Oh, so he should not take a Carnival cruise anytime soon. He's not going to just get to go off on vacation.
No, he won't be sitting in Houston practicing law. He's probably going to have to answer the Senate Judiciary Committee for a long time to come.
David Marks, senior editor for Politico.com. Thanks for walking through today's news with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, of course, we were all out having a lot of fun this weekend.
Except for me. I was sick. I was on the couch.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, for those of us who were out having fun, there were probably some news stories that we missed, which is why we have our segment we like to call While You Were Out, and Rachel Martin's going to be here to catch us up on that news.
Also, we're going to discuss some teeny tiny sculpture, a guy who makes microscopic sculptures, including a model of the thinker that can fit on the head of a pin.
You think you've seen small. You have not seen small till you look at the photographs of this guy's work.
Our video producer, Wynn Rosenfeld, has done the legwork for that. He'll come in and join us in the studio. We'll also post that video online. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is the Bryant Park Project. From NPR News, I'm Luke Burbank.
I'm Alison Stewart. Hey, everybody. Monday morning, did you get your head back in the game after checking out mentally and physically all weekend? We're here to help you out with our weekly segment to get you going called While You Were Out, possibly barbecuing.
Watching your team botch an otherwise totally winnable football game.
Couch surfing, cleaning gutters. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you had a bad weekend, didn't you?
I did, but let's not get focused on that.
Okay.
Let's stay
sorry.
With the news
Seahawks.
Of the weekend. Yeah, please. That's a rabbit hole we don't need to go down. All right, joining us now to catch up on the weekend news you might have missed is our very own Rachel Martin. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, guys.
All right, so what are some of the big stories people might have missed?
Well, there were a few things going on in the world of politics and Washington, D.C. There was a pretty sizable demonstration yesterday in Washington. Several thousand people were marching in downtown Washington in an anti-war protest. A few of the people, it got a little bit rowdy. People tried to jump over a police barrier, and police had to use chemical spray against them. About 190 of the protesters were actually arrested as they marched towards the Capitol. And they held banners and chanted against troop withdrawal. That seemed to be the major theme of the event, is pushing for some kind of timeline and withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. And people also sprawled around on the ground in what organizers called a symbolic die-in, as opposed to the sit-in. And also, this is a story that is all over the British papers and media. We've talked about it on our show, is the abduction, apparent abduction, kidnapping of Maddie.
Madeleine McCann.
Madeleine McCann, thank you. Known also as Maddie to her parents and friends, I am sure. And the parents of this little girl are getting some big name help now. Richard Branson, who's the Virgin Atlantic tycoon, has donated $200,000 to help the parents with their legal costs. He'd already given them $2 million to set up a fund to help Madeleine.
Because the parents are now officially suspects
exactly.
in this case.
The parents have now been named suspects. This is kind of the linchpin in this whole thing. She was missing for a while, and there was a lot of sympathy that was projected towards the parents. And now things have kind of turned now that those two have been named as suspects in the investigation. And
Richard Branson, though, still standing behind them, I guess.
Standing behind them and encouraging other people with a lot of money to penny up and help them. He seems to think that that they need some help with their legal fees and that they won't get that unless they get a fair trial. So he's definitely speaking up for them and encouraging other people to do the same. And also, last Friday, there was some riveting testimony in the trial of a former polygamist and leader of a religious sect, the trial taking place in St. George, Utah, of Warren Jeffs. And Jeffs is charged with two felony counts of rape as an accomplice for using his church position to coerce a marriage between a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old cousin. And prosecutors contend that he misused his power over this young girl. And this young woman, who's now 21, gave her testimony on Friday about her objections to the marriage. And NPR's Wade Goodwin was in the courtroom, and reported on that testimony. Here's some of that report, beginning with this really powerful testimony of the girl describing her wedding night.
And I just said, I can't do this. Please, just don't. And I was sobbing, and my whole entire body was just shaking because I was so, so scared. And he didn't say anything. He just laid me on the bed and had sex.
The girl's ongoing resistance is a vital element of the prosecution's case against Jeffs. In order to convict, they must convince the jury the girl was raped. Her emotional testimony about her humiliation left the courtroom stunned and subdued.
I laid there completely numb and shocked. I felt dirty and used. I just curled up in a ball and laid there for a long time and just tried to forget.
The girl got off the bed, went into the bathroom, and closed the door.
And there was a couple of bottles of painkiller on the counter. I took both bottles. The only thing I wanted to do was to die. I just wanted to die.
The teenager didn't die. She just got violently ill. In desperation, she went to Warren Jeffs and once again pleaded with him, this time to release her from her marriage. Jeffs was unmoved.
He told me that I needed to go home and give myself to my husband, mind, body, and soul.
So that
and
was
obey without question.
That was NPR's Wade Goodwin. And that, we should note, defense attorneys for Warren Jeffs will cross-examine the girl today. And that's what happened while you were out.
You know, you guys were
things.
Queuing that tape up before the show, that Warren Jeffs tape, and it's just like it was broadcasting out of someone's computer speakers, and it was like there's this palpable feeling of sadness that filled up like the entire 19th floor. I mean, it's really intense stuff.
Yeah, it was very intense testimony. So.
Rachel, thank you very much for filling us in over the weekend.
You're welcome, you guys.
The Bryant Park Project shares our space here with all the New York-based correspondents. And someone, was it you, Lou, or was it Dan, who
it
walked by
me.
Pesca's desk? Okay, yes. You walked by Mike Pesca's desk, as you are wont to do.
Yes.
And there was a newspaper on his desk, among many other things, that said, "World Praise as Sharon Felled by Stroke." Now, the headline was, of course, referring to then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, whose stroke on January 4th, 2006, left him in a coma where he remains today. Now, at the time of his stroke, Sharon had just formed a new political party called Kadima, which was aimed to bridge that gap between Israel's traditionally most powerful parties, the left-wing Labor and right-wing Likud. Now, in the interim, Ehud Olmert has taken control, but with a figure as powerful as Sharon still living, technically, does Sharon's legacy have an effect on Israeli politics today? Has time changed that legacy? And that headline just brought all those questions back to us. So we want to get a handle on what Sharon has left behind. Joining us now from Jerusalem is Herb Kanon, diplomatic correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Herb, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Is Ariel Sharon even still a topic of discussion? Is he top of mind with Israelis?
Not at all. Since he fell into his stroke, a couple months later after Olmert took over power, had elections, people don't hear about him much. He's not in the news at all.
How has Olmert's performance or the perception of his performance been affected by Sharon's still presence and his legacy?
Look, I mean, the very fact that Olmert is prime minister, I mean, he owes that to Ariel Sharon, right? I mean, he swept into power pretty much on the wings of Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon set up the Kadima Party, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Olmert was seen as his successor. He took over when people voted for Kadima. To a large extent, they were voting for what they thought was a continuation of Sharon's legacy. But in this country, when things move so quickly, and they do indeed move quickly, the whole perception of Sharon's legacy has changed a great deal over the last, what, year and three quarters, and as such also the way the country looks at Olmert.
Do you think that people in Israel consider Ariel Sharon to be alive?
Yeah, I mean, he's breathing, right? He's in a hospital and he's breathing. There's no doubt that technically he's alive. Nobody raises any questions about that.
Yeah, Sharon's family has said, though, they won't remove the life-extending treatment, citing religious issues. According to the Associated Press, under established Jewish legal codes, it's forbidden to do anything to hasten death, but other teachings saying it's permissible to remove an impediment, is the word they use, standing in the way of natural end to life, such as feeding tube or a respirator. You know, rabbis remain deeply divided over what constitutes an unreasonable obstacle to death. Based on your reporting, would there be any kind of outcry if Sharon were to be removed life-extending equipment?
The whole issue of euthanasia, mercy killing in Israel. It's a very complicated issue legally, right? Once you're on a life support system, it's very difficult to quote unquote pull the plug. You can't do anything actively. Both in Jewish law and in Israeli law, to pull the plug. I mean, you do not have to actively intervene in order to resuscitate somebody, but you can't pull the plug. Now, there were a couple cases over last year where the doctors, at the request of the children, did actively intervene in order to save his life.
Right, he's had several surgeries, right?
Yeah. I mean, they were asked a couple times to resuscitate.
Sharon has always been somewhat of a controversial figure in some ways. It was interesting that we chose this week to do this because this weekend is the 15th anniversary of the Sabra incident, where so many people were killed when he was a defense minister and he let militias into Beirut. But he's also the guy who withdrew from Gaza in 2005. So in the absence of his own personal presence and his ability to create his own legacy and rewrite his legacy, how has the absence from the public eye affected the perception of Ariel Sharon in the past 2 years?
I think it's impacted negatively on the perception, because he's unable to defend himself to the Israeli public. Now I'm speaking. I'm not talking about Sabra Shatil. I'm talking about the Israeli perception mm-hmm. of him, and he's unable to defend himself to a number of questions about what policies that he took over the last couple of years. Number one was the whole buildup of Hezbollah in Lebanon from 2000 to 2006. We went to war in Lebanon last summer to a large extent because of that buildup. A lot of people are asking the question, well, where were Sharon during this time period? How come he didn't take more active, aggressive actions to stop that buildup there? Okay, so he's unable to answer those questions. This is a question that is being dealt with now by a National Commission of Inquiry looking into the Second Lebanese War, and he can't defend himself. The other thing is disengagement from Gaza. Disengagement from Gaza did not turn out the way that Sharon promised the country it would, right? And so he's come under a lot of criticism for that move as well, and he's unable to defend himself.
Herb Kanon, diplomatic correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
When we started talking about Ariel Sharon, we got to wondering some sort of medical questions, about sort of what happens to the human body when you're in the state that Ariel Sharon is in. And we thought we should get somebody who actually knows about this stuff on. We're bringing on Dr. Carmelo Graffanino, director of the Neuroscience Critical Care Unit at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Graffanino.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you for coming on. We know you haven't examined Ariel Sharon yourself, but, we do know he's been diagnosed as being in a persistent vegetative state. And when a patient is in that kind of state, what's actually going on inside the body?
Well, that's a very good question, because people have had a very difficult time conceptually understanding or grabbing the differences between coma, persistent vegetative state, brain death, obtundation. There's a lot of words used. And one of the problems is that people conceive these situations as being absolutes, that you go from being awake to asleep to a coma. And it's really not. It's really a gradation of levels of consciousness. So our brain is kept awake by a center that's in the brainstem that sends messages up to the cortex, the hemispheres, the part of the brain where we do our thinking and our processing.
I was really surprised to read that the spectrum starts with mildly drowsy and goes to comatose. Mildly drowsy doesn't seem like a very medical term for someone.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the problems is that we have moved away from trying to use words such as obtundation and stupor, and even to a degree coma, to being much more descriptive of what the patient actually does when a certain stimulus is applied. So if I told you that someone is mildly drowsy and that when I call their name out, they wake up and start talking to you, I think that you have a pretty good understanding of what level of drowsiness that person has, compared to if I use the word they're in a stupor or they're in an obtunded state. Same with words such as coma. So when the patient or the individual person begins to lose the stimulatory part of their brain that keeps them awake, the hemisphere, the part of the brain that controls your thinking, starts to function less.
Well, let's talk about Ariel Sharon for a moment. Some of the functions of his body are being helped along by a series of machines. And I guess the question is, if you have a device that's causing your heart to beat and you're being fed, I mean, couldn't someone live indefinitely in this state? What would actually kill you?
Well, the problem is that as you stay in a relatively immobile state where you are needing your entire body to function, you start to become vulnerable to the effects of lacking your brain input. So our brain not only controls our thinking, it's intimately related to our immune system, it's related to the way our endocrine glands work, and our body, as an individual whole person, needs to continue to have an integration between the two. So the patient becomes exposed to potential infections, their muscles break down, their immune system weakens, and most people who are in prolonged support on ventilators or in persistent vegetative states where they're being fed are able to survive for sometimes years, but gradually these things become impossible to maintain, and they become exposed to more infections, clots in their legs, ulcers, and those are all mechanisms that can cause a person to die. The most common cause of death that we see in long-term ventilated patients are things such as pneumonias or pulmonary embolisms, clots that form in the legs and go to the lungs, even with best attempts at trying to prevent them.
Dr. Graffanino, you deal with a lot of people who are in this sort of vegetative state. Do you ever look into their eyes and wonder, I wonder what's going on back there? Do you stay up at night thinking about that?
That's a difficult issue in the sense that when we think of persistent vegetative states, we're thinking of people that essentially have lost the being of who they are. The very basic aspects of their brain function, such as those things that are needed to keep your heart beating, to keep your blood circulating, to keep your lungs breathing, are working. But the substance of the individual person, their cortex, their personality, their individualism, them as a person, isn't there. So they could look to somebody who is not used to it as though they may be there. And in fact, you even see sometimes reflex yawns and movements. And that really is disturbing to loved ones who perceive that the individual they knew is still underneath there.
Which may go to the point of Ariel Sharon's family not wanting him to be brought off the life support. Dr. Carmelo Graffanino, Director of the Neuroscience Critical Care Unit at Duke University Medical Center, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, the collected works of sculptor Willard Wiegand sold for over 11 million British pounds. If you go to Etsy.com, the currency converter, that is 22 million U.S. dollars. His subjects include the Titanic hitting an iceberg, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Statue of Liberty.
All right, that sounds fine, but you have to realize that Wiegand brings a remarkable perspective to these subjects because they are very, very small. Very, very, very small. In fact, many of his works aren't even visible to the naked eye. Wiegand starts with a grain of sand or rice. He carves them with a diamond shard, looking through a microscope, and he's actually apparently lost sometimes months of work by accidentally inhaling a sculpture or sneezing one of these pieces of work away.
Ow.
Yeah, someone who never sneezes their work away is our own Wynne Rosenfeld. You actually spoke with Wiegand last week about this technique?
I did, yeah.
First question, is he an odd sort when you speak to someone like that on the phone?
He was very frustrated. He's often, when he's in the middle of working on a piece, he really loses himself. He says he derives no pleasure from the actual carving process itself. And so he goes through these very intense periods, and then when he's finished, he's sort of feels great.
But I mean, if I talk to this guy on the street, I think, there's a guy who carves rice. Like, do you know what I'm saying
about his diamond?
Well, he's proud of himself, though. I mean, you know, he's an odd duck.
Okay, I'm seeing here in the notes that he's actually severely learning disabled.
That's right, yeah. And his is actually, that sort of was his entree into carving very, very small things. As a kid, he was put down a lot by his teachers and by, you know, and he was sort of very strict parochial school where they made him feel very small. And so he sort of felt that he related to things like ants and bugs and little tiny things very intimately. And so he started building houses for ants at age 5, and that's just kind of become his career.
Well, we have a piece of your interview. Can you lead us to the tape?
Yeah, this is actually him talking about the most frustrating of this very frustrating process is the painting. And here's him talking a little about how that goes.
If there's ever a chance of me losing my sanity, I think the painting would do that. Because I have to thin down the paint so thin, crushing the molecules, using different thinners, oils, thinning it down. And then for a paintbrush, I have to find a dead fly and pluck the hair off the fly's back and make a paintbrush. I'm trying to apply the paint without it smudging. Some microscopic fragment of dust may land on it, and then you try to remove it, and then it smudges it, and then it goes wrong. And then it's just pain.
Okay, yes, he's intense. Yes.
I have to go take the hairs off a fly's back to make a paintbrush.
Yeah, and he's a humanitarian. He believes in animal rights, and he only has to find a dead
rights.
Tie.
Apparently
not. A dead fly?
Dead
okay.
Flies.
All right, if you want to see this and much more, you've got to go to our website, BPP. That's npr.org/Bryant Park, where Wynne's video is. Wynne, thank you for telling us about it.
Thanks, guys.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, sports with Bill Wolf. This is NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Luke Burbank. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park, but you're probably listening to the show there, so we're not telling you anything you don't know.
But you can come back and visit anytime.
Please
you
do.
Like.
Please do.
We're open for business.
You're
24/7.
Allison Stewart, aren't
I'm
you?
I'm Allison Stewart. Dang it. Coming up, the news you choose, the most emailed and clicked on stories around the web today, a segment we like to call The Most. Nice title. But first, let's hear about the more traditionally generated headlines. Today's top stories from our own newscaster, Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey everyone, there's some big news in Pakistan today. After serving as both the Pakistani president and chief of the army for the past 8 years, Pervez Musharraf has announced he'll hand in his general's uniform. Senior members of Musharraf's political party said today that Musharraf plans to quit as army chief and serve instead as a civilian president. The move comes just a week before Musharraf hopes to be re-elected as the country's leader. He's kept his military leadership position after he seized political control of the country in a military coup in 1999. The decision could be seen as a victory for the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. There has been talk that Bhutto and Musharraf may strike a power-sharing deal, but Bhutto has said she wouldn't agree to such a plan unless Musharraf surrendered his military position. And authorities in Thailand have found the two flight data recorders that were on board the plane that crashed yesterday on the island of Phuket, killing 90 people. The budget One2Go Airlines flight was carrying 124 passengers and 7 crew from Bangkok to the resort island of Phuket when pilots tried to land the plane in heavy wind and rain. The plane skidded off the runway, rammed into a retaining wall, and was soon engulfed in flames. Thailand's transport minister said the plane's data boxes would be sent to the United States for analysis. And Microsoft has been dealt a blow by a European court over antitrust practices. The software giant lost its appeal of an EU court order that said the company was abusing its dominance in the market. Under that ruling in 2004, Microsoft was ordered to share its communications code with rivals. It has to sell a copy of Windows that doesn't include the media player, and it has to pay over $600 million in fines. The court said the European Commission was right when it concluded that Microsoft was guilty of monopoly abuse. Microsoft can appeal the decision to the EU's highest court within 2 months. And it's time for a little movie news. What was hot at the box office last weekend? Well, Jodie Foster's public radio host-turned-vigilante flick, The Brave One, brought in about $14 million at the box office to become the weekend's top film. The film was displaced last week's box office winner, 310 to Yuma, which placed second with $9.2 million in ticket sales. And the David Cronenberg crime thriller, Eastern Promises, took a good draw, playing on 15 screens around the country. The film about Russian mobsters in London stars Naomi Watts and Viggo Mortensen of Lord of the Rings fame, my favorite. The news is always online at NPR.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Easy, hobbits.
All right. I spent quite a bit of time watching sports this weekend. I know you'll be shocked to hear that, Luke.
Well, you said you were sick early in the show. I thought, oh, that meant that it was like misery.
Yeah. I was held captive on the couch in front of the 50-inch TV. Yeah. That's love. You know you're in love when you let your new husband put up a 50-inch television in your home. Fortunately, I have my own personal guide. I think I should often just put a headset on my husband, Bill, to do color commentary from the kitchen. I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. Guy spent 15 years working at ESPN, pinch hitting on ESPN talk radio. So what's a girl to do? She's to call up her husband for a Monday morning quarterback session. Let's get Bill Wolf on the line. Hey, Bill.
Well, hello, Allison.
How are you?
To what do I owe the pleasure?
Can we talk a little sports? Can
I'd
you walk
to.
Me through some of what happened this weekend?
That would be a pleasure.
All right, so the game that everyone watched, I only watched it till halftime, frankly, the New England Patriots last night. And when I went to bed, they were winning. So did they end up embarrassing San Diego?
Embarrassing? They crushed them. They pummeled them, yes. It did not get closer in the second half. New England really put a hurt into them, which was remarkable because, as you know, Allison, San Diego is really good and regarded as probably one of the top, say, three teams in the league, and New England, another one of those teams, just put the wood to them, as we like to say.
It looked like it was like an NFL team playing like a varsity team from a high school. LaDainian Tomlinson, the Chargers running back, who's amazing, is like he looked like flummoxed. He couldn't get a yard.
Well, and it's also, it's especially remarkable because New England has is without two of its best players on defense, Richard Seymour and Rodney Harrison. And so for them to dominate San Diego, like you said, Luke, especially defensively against the offense of San Diego is really something else. New England looks fearsome in the early going.
But there was one thing I did notice as I was sitting there watching the sports. Mm-hmm. And when the news part of it came in, I perked up because I kept hearing all these references to the situation. In fact, I said to you, why do they have a close-up of all those monitors? Mm-hmm. It's because of they were monitoring the video waves due to this whole spying scandal that happened last week, that the Patriots were spying on the sideline signals.
Yeah, the Patriots got busted actually for video surveillance against the Jets last week, the New York Jets in New York. I guess the Patriots dispatched some staffer with a camera to videotape the signals that the Jets were sending to each other about which defensive strategy they were going to use. So the coach, Bill Belichick, was held responsible by the commissioner of the league, and he personally, Belichick, was fined $500,000, and the Patriots were penalized. They're going to have to give up a draft pick in a future draft for spying. And then last night there was all this new spying on the Patriots, spying to make sure they weren't spying.
Let's listen to a little bit of how Al Michaels and John Madden handled it.
Mm-hmm.
You had every distraction in the world that could have done in the New England Patriots tonight, John. And then of all things, here they come out and they dominate. They look great against a quality team, and they're 2-0 right now.
Right, and with all the distractions, they worked right through it.
Could they say distraction one more time? Was it a distraction for you as a sports fan?
No.
Okay.
No. I think I have a fairly well-developed speech, which took about 15 seconds to develop, but much longer to say, but I'll try to be quick. Everybody in every sport on every level spies all the time. Every time, like if we watch football, darling, and I know we will because you'll demand it, when they show shots of the coaches on the sidelines talking to their players, the coaches will hold a clipboard in front of their mouths. Now, why would they do that? Simple chronic halitosis?
Possibly.
Possibly, but doubtful. It's because they're worried that someone is looking and reading their lips and finding out what their strategy is going to be. When you watch a baseball game and the catcher goes out to the pitcher and they're talking about what they're going to do to the batter, the pitcher will hold his glove over his mouth while he talks. Now, why is that? Same question. Simple
spying.
Chronic halitosis, maybe. But because of spying, it's the oldest trick in the book. It's something that everybody does on all levels. So why this was considered such a humongous deal is beyond me. But everyone except me, seems to think it is a huge deal. I just don't get it.
I want to move on to college football here.
Yeah.
One of the games I did actually watch for a while.
Yeah, you watched that when I wasn't even there.
Florida versus
you're busted, pal.
Tennessee. I really wasn't feeling very well. I couldn't even change the remote.
Yeah.
The score
you were
was
delirious.
The score was something like 59-20.
Yeah.
Florida versus Tennessee.
Yeah.
Are you supposed to do that? Run up the score like that?
Well, you're not supposed to. But you do.
It's like spying.
Well, you're not supposed to. It's bad form when you are dominating another team to try to make the score even worse. But there are a couple of extenuating circumstances, I think. One is because college football is determined by subjective standards. They have people voting about who is the best team. When you run up the score, it helps you in the end. Everybody says, wow, Florida really whacked Tennessee. Man, they must be excellent.
So it becomes part of your resume, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. But that positively becomes part of your resume.
Let's talk about somebody's resume not looking good.
Yeah.
Notre Dame. We talked about this on the show, these two powerhouses, Michigan and Notre Dame. Who is the stinkier of the stinkiest when they should both be the best? So who's the stinkiest? Who gets that honor?
Oh, my Lord.
Boy.
Notre Dame is not just the stinkier of those two. Notre Dame is among the stinkiest assemblages of human beings on the planet.
They're like Limburger, and Michigan was like a Glade potpourri. It was not even close.
It was like the U.S. invading Grenada. It was unbelievable. And Notre Dame is the metaphor for excellence in college football, and they got stomped at Michigan by a team that hadn't won a game yet. 38-0, which is a stomping of regal proportions. So Notre Dame is suddenly 0-3.
Are they over?
Well, they're over for this season.
Yeah, done.
They're over for this season. They haven't scored. Their offensive team their offensive squad has not scored a touchdown yet. The only points they've scored have been on the kicking game and the defense. They haven't scored a touchdown. This is Notre Dame we're talking about.
I have to just say that as somebody who grew up watching so many subpar Notre Dame games on national TV, because they had a deal with NBC that every one of their game would be on, it's so nice to see them taking the fall. Because I'm just so sick of watching them.
Okay, this brings me to my next subject, the New York Yankees. You sports people and your schadenfreude. Okay, Friday night, I go to sleep.
Schadenfreude.
And the Yankees were behind a whole bunch to the Red Sox, like 7 points behind. I wake up Saturday.
Runs.
Points.
Points, sorry, runs, whatever. So I wake up Saturday, and they've won. Mm. And they're talking about this big comeback. And you and I are having brunch. And you got a little testy with me when I was like, hey, look. Oh, yes, you did.
I hadn't had coffee.
So what? Of course they won. They have the better players, right?
Yes. Being excited about a Yankee comeback is like being excited that the Chinese economy overcame a little bump in the road and dominated the world. It's a story that's written before it's played out. The Yankees have more talent, more highly priced talent than anyone. So when they come back and have these pseudo-glorious, heroic underdog moments, it's a fraud, and no one should be allowed to feel good about it. It's a foregone conclusion, and it angers me enormously. You can't feel good about the Yankees. The Yankees are Goliath. They are not David.
It's rooting for Darth Vader in Star Wars.
Well, but Darth Vader had heart, man.
That's an insult to Darth Vader.
I am your father, Luke. The Yankees are nobody's father. The Yankees are a cold, heartless corporate monolith.
You know, we actually learned the accurate quote on that, Bill. You misquoted it. It's, I am your father, Luke, whatever.
Okay, finally. So I'm listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Chris Paul of the New Orleans Hornets was the guest.
Yeah.
And Peter Sagal kept saying, it's their first sports guest ever to play Not My Job. Let's play a little bit of this weekend's show.
You are not, despite your astonishing talent and ability and drive and discipline, you are not, for an NBA player, a particularly tall guy.
I'm 6 foot, 6'1 on a good day.
Okay. 6'1 when it's humid and you swell a bit.
Exactly.
So do the other guys sort of tease you? Do they put the sodas up on a really high shelf and make you jump? I mean,
they try different things, but at the end of the day, I'm the point guard. So the only way they can get the ball is through me.
Right.
So there. So if this guy's about 6 feet, 6'1".
5'11".
Yeah, you're dreaming. Mr.
No, really, he might be 5'11".
Really?
They always lie on the programs and make
the best color. They're like chicks in their weight?
Yeah, but it's the opposite.
Well,
it's the opposite, but yeah.
So if he's this little guy in the NBA, what's his skill set?
Extraordinary quickness, which is different from speed. You know, it's the difference between motion and locomotion. He can get short distances extremely quickly and make decisions extremely quickly to go in whatever direction it is. And he's so quick that no one can stay in front of him. He gets around people just by virtue of his extraordinary quickness. He's also a very good shooter. He can shoot the basketball very well. But the real answer, in my view, is his understanding of the game. Basketball is about positioning, and it's about movement, and it's about spatial relation. The players have to sort of spread out in the right places in order to be open, in order to be able to take easy shots. And there's just something to it. You know, there's rhythm to it and improvisation to it. And Chris Paul is a genius at that. He just understands basketball on a higher level than most people. And he's 22 years old. He's always been known as mature beyond his years. So he's very calm. He's very smart, and he's very calm.
So you folks were listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. There's a little explainer on why it was such a big, fat, hairy deal to have Chris Paul on the show.
A short, not that hairy deal.
Okay, I'm not even walking into that one, Bill Wolf.
Sorry,
I know,
babe.
You just opened the door for a really bad joke, and
sorry,
that won't
babe.
Happen.
I'm sorry.
That's right. Not on this program. Not on national. Not when we're being observed by the New York Times.
Oh,
we don't
Lord.
Do that on this show.
The gray ladies in the house.
That's right.
All right. Bill Wolf, thank you so much for walking us through sports today.
You know, it's my pleasure.
I'll see you later.
Okay, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's get to some of the most emailed, viewed, and commented on stories on the old webs today. Something we call the most.
Yes, we're going to start with our producers who have just wandered into the studio. They've picked out the most that they like the most. Ilya, what do you got?
Ilya Maritz, by the way, producer extraordinaire.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Where's it from? Let's start with that.
My most is from topics.net. It's a news aggregator, and they do this really great graph where they show like what search terms are spiking the most right now. And their top story today is Rosie O'Donnell reveals that as a child she broke her own bones on purpose.
What?
Yeah, she used a baseball bat and a wooden coat hanger to do it. And she says it was actually to deal with the grief over her mother's death. Her mother died when she was 10. And she wanted to, let's see.
Is this in a new book? Is this this new book she wrote? The one where she's dissing Barbara Walters, among other people?
It's like every page of this book is something that I have to say is totally riveting sounding, I mean, for better or for worse.
Celebrity Detox is the book. Okay. It's out in October. What I think is interesting, I mean, what jumped out at me about this is you knew she was going to call Donald a slime bag, and you knew she was going to say Barbara Walters was...
Donald Trump,
old and past your time. But you didn't know she said she was going to mutilate herself. So that was kind of strange. Also, interestingly, she, you know, her big break was as Doris Murphy in A League of Their Own in 1992, wielding a baseball bat.
Oh... Nobody cries in baseball. Best line from that movie, Thomas. All right, Ilya, thanks a lot. So, Dan Pashman, you're always good for a good most.
Oh, am I? Thank you.
Yeah.
This one, actually, I have to be honest, Allison, you're the expert on this, so I hope this falls into the category. This is actually the most likely to be the most emailed story very soon.
Okay, I think that's stretching it, but I'll let you pass this time because I know what the story is and it's really good.
And if it helps, this is already the most emailed story by Dan Pashman. So if that counts for anything.
It's it's a real niche category.
Yeah, exactly. The bathroom in the Minneapolis airport where Senator Larry Craig was arrested has become a tourist attraction. People are flocking there, taking pictures, posing outside the stall, etc. Apparently, this woman works at the information kiosk at the airport. In the first 15 minutes of her shift on Friday, four people had asked her for directions. So if you're ever in that airport, it's by the lottery shop right next to the shoeshine shop.
Specializing in wide stances.
Exactly. Well, actually, I kind of know where that – it's a separate terminal from the big main one. It's not the one that's like the big shopping mall. It's a little bit dingy and kind of resembles a bus station a little bit more than an airline terminal, frankly.
Right.
All right. That's –
I've got a most from the NPR website, npr.org's most emailed story today is this, I believe, as it often is. Mm-hmm. On Monday morning. It's an essay by somebody named David Buto about his dog. It's titled Teaching a Bad Dog New Tricks. And right behind it on NPR, the most emailed story that won't go away, a recipe for fish tacos by food writer Susan Russo.
Nobody understands why the fish tacos are in the top 10.
We got to start doing recipes in the BPP.
Oh, nice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right,
Dan.
I make a mean Rice Krispie treat.
Bring it.
All right.
Dan Pashman and Ilya Maritz, thank you for bringing us some of the most
looked
at stories.
Thank you.
Coming up on the next hour of the Bryant Park Project, the big story, O.J. Simpson arrested.
Oh, come on, Orenthal James. We'll talk about that and a lot more. That's on the other side of the hour here on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We'll be right back.
From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It is Monday, September 17th. Thank you so much for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Allison Stewart here.
I'm Luke Burbank. Allison, this is the first time I've tried to do the show sans coffee.
How's it going for you over there?
So far, so good. But if I start to crash, or if you just see my head on the keyboard at some point here in the second hour, just...
I'll come over and goose you.
Do something, please.
All right. The Gina 6. We've been doing that all morning. Civil rights leaders are set to converge later this week on a small Louisiana town that's grappling with racism and unequal justice.
Also, the aftermath of a bad restaurant review, a Philly food critic is being sued, and his secret identity has actually been revealed to his readers by a rival magazine and now all the restaurants in town. We'll talk to him and someone else about that story.
Also, as promised, we're keeping you up to speed on headlines from yesteryear, or at least last month anyway. A Minneapolis bridge. We're going to go back and look at that story that dominated earlier this summer but has dropped off the front page. The collapse of the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Where does the funding and the repair stand?
And where does this guy stand? This guy who we kept playing on Friday's show, his name's Jeremy Harper. He counted to a million. It took him something like 89 or 90 days. He finally got there on Friday, and we're going to talk to him and find out what he's going to do with his life now that he's scaled that height.
We'll also get today's headlines from newscaster Rachel Martin in just a minute. But first, here's the BPP's big story.
Arenthal James Simpson, get into my office. O.J. Simpson was arrested last night in Las Vegas, charged with 2 counts of robbery with a deadly weapon, 2 counts of assault with a deadly weapon, and conspiracy to commit a crime and burglary with a firearm. This, according to Las Vegas police.
Here's apparently what happened. He entered a hotel room with several other men and confronted collectors whom O.J. claims stole memorabilia from him. One of the collectors Simpson was confronting was Bruce Fromung, a former friend of Simpson's who appeared today on ABC's Good Morning America. Here's how he described the incident.
The guys that were coming through the door, because as soon as they started coming through the door in the fashion that they did, I knew what was going on. But to see OJ, the last one through the door, it was that was the biggest surprise of all. You could see he stopped for just a second, and he saw me and I saw him, and for a minute you could see he stopped. And like I say, the thing in my mind, as soon as I saw him, I'm thinking, OJ, how can you be this dumb?
Question on many people's mind this morning, probably. Apparently now there's an audio recording which claims to be OJ in that hotel room. It's been posted on the website TMZ.com. The tape is kind of fuzzy, so if I can just paraphrase, OJ is essentially saying, "Do you think you can take my personal possessions? Do not let anyone leave here. Do you think you can take my personal possessions?" Here's some of that tape.
"Think you can steal my shit and sell it? Don't let nobody out of here. You motherfucker.
Quite a mouth on O.J. Simpson. Jeez. So between the statements of collector Frong and that audio tape, it seems hard to question whether Mr. Simpson was in the hotel room, but whether he broke the law is for the courts to decide. It is important to note that Fromung also told ABC News today that O.J. Simpson himself was not carrying firearms, which may throw into question some of the firearm-related charges.
And that is the BPP big story. Now here's Rachel Martin with the rest of the news.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. President Bush today has announced his choice for the country's new attorney general, Michael Mukasey, a former judge and prosecutor from New York. If confirmed, the 66-year-old Mukasey would replace Alberto Gonzalez, who resigned last month after a controversy over the firings of 9 federal prosecutors. Democrats have praised the choice, saying Mukasey is neither a close confidant of the president nor a Washington insider. Mukasey was appointed to the federal bench by President Ronald Reagan in 1987 and retired last year to go into private practice. If the Senate confirms him, Mukasey will be the 3rd attorney general to serve under George W. Bush. An American private security firm has been kicked out of Iraq following a shooting in Baghdad in which 11 people were killed. An Interior Ministry spokesman said Blackwater contractors opened fire against civilians in Baghdad yesterday after mortar rounds landed near their vehicles. 11 people were killed, including one policeman, and 13 wounded. The Iraqi government has withdrawn Blackwater's license to work in the country and plans to prosecute those involved. Thousands of private security contractors, many of them American and European, have worked in Iraq since the U.S. invasion in 2003. And his words can still move markets. So when former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan writes a book condemning the current Bush administration on its fiscal policy, it makes big headlines. Greenspan was in papers and on television shows over the weekend promoting the release of his memoirs, released today. The book is called The Age of Turbulence, Adventures in the New World. And in it, the economic guru criticizes both congressional Republicans and President George W. Bush for abandoning fiscal discipline. Greenspan writes that congressional Republicans, quote, swapped principle for power and ended up with neither. In an interview with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes last night, Greenspan criticized the Bush administration's tax cuts.
Their economic policy largely was to take the proposals made during the campaign when there was a prospective very large surplus, and that those policies continued in place irrespective of what was happening to the surplus.
Well, that's very rigid.
I don't know if it was rigid. It was wrong.
Greenspan retired in early 2006 after 18 years as chairman of the Federal Reserve. He has served under six presidents as either Fed chairman or advisor. And let's talk a little football, as I'm known to do. In Sunday Night Football, the Patriots sprinted to a 24-0 halftime lead over the Chargers and cruised to a 38-14 victory in New England. In daytime action yesterday, Brett Favre became the winningest quarterback in NFL history, recording his 149th career victory when the Packers beat the Giants 35-13. The news is always online at NPR.org. I'm Rachel Martin. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Rachel.
230 miles northwest of New Orleans, a small town of about 3,000 has been gripped by a legal case involving six black teenagers who beat up a white teenager. It happened in Gina, Louisiana, last December. The beaten kid was knocked unconscious, but was ultimately okay. Now, the black teenagers were charged with attempted murder, which holds a conviction of up to 50 years in prison. One of the young men, the first to go to trial, Michael Bell, was convicted as an adult. Friday, that conviction was overturned by a state appeals court. So was justice not as colorblind as it should have been in this case? The question is up for discussion, not only because of the weight of the charges, but also because of how the original fight, that original altercation, how it all started. Katie Rechtel is a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Can you help us with the backstory on this a little bit? Explain to us why these boys, these black teenagers, just whooped up on this one student. What had been happening at the school?
There had been, dating back about 3 months, there had been a really racially charged atmosphere that began, to my understanding, when a black teenager, not one of the ones charged, by the way, not one of the kids charged, but a black teenager had asked to sit in the schoolyard underneath an oak tree that was sort of a gathering place for white students. The assistant principal said that was fine, but apparently within a few days there were three nooses hanging from that tree.
So,
and that began a series of back-and-forth incidents where lots of taunts, lots of, you know, epithets, and finally I think it really culminated in December with the fight that these six teenagers are charged for.
So one of the young men who was charged, Michael Bell, he was, as we mentioned, charged, convicted, the conviction overturned. He's been in jail since December. Was he considered someone in the school who caused trouble?
No, I don't think so. Everyone says that he was a really good student, a role model, that he was absolutely a star athlete and was weighing several college scholarship offers at the time of his arrest.
What about the victim in this case? Has he spoken out about the racial component of this story at all?
You know, I haven't really heard a lot about this, about the victim. I think that they have remained fairly quiet. The student's name is Justin Barker, and he was, according to the teenagers who've been charged, he was involved in some of the previous incidents as well.
So the status of the other defendants, do the charges still stand for them?
Yes. And they, to my understanding, the first one who has a trial date is another kid named Robert Bailey, and his trial date is in November. That's the next trial date.
One of the questions that comes to mind is, since most of us in the country didn't know about Gina, Louisiana until a little while ago, is it a town that has been known for having a racially charged environment? Because that's one of the big issues here. The question is, were these black teenagers given much harsher sentences than perhaps some white teenagers have been given in the past for various mischievous acts?
I think that Gina did. People tell me that there is a history of it. History of racism in Gina. I think it's not uncommon for small towns that are so segregated to have problems, and so Gina may be in the national press right now, but it certainly is not alone in its confrontation of this issue.
Was this a big story locally for you and for the local media there? Because it's obviously blown up nationally.
Right, right. I mean, I think that it has become a big story here. I think that all of us were sort of caught flat-footed when the charges were brought. We didn't really think that the judge would convict. And the charges just seemed, as they seemed to everybody who has heard about them, I think, excessive. By the way, the court that overturned the conviction noted the original murder charges that were brought were amended the day before they started picking the jury for Michael Bell's case. And when those charges were amended back down to battery, that case should have moved to juvenile court instead of moving to adult court, which hears all murder cases, almost all murder cases. And so that's the issue that brought Michael Bell's, that overturned Michael Bell's conviction. You know, when we had first heard about it, and up until, you know, the day before the trial, second-degree murder for a group of kids in a schoolyard fight just seemed like there would be no way a judge would convict.
That's why it's gotten so very much national attention. Hey, Katie Rechtall, reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Thanks for filling in the blanks for us.
No, thank you for having me.
Jordan Flaherty lives in New Orleans, and he's been spending a great deal of his time recently in Gina, working with the community, writing about it on his website, leftturn.org. Jordan is with us now. Hi there.
Hi, Luke. Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Something that I was really interested in reading about this Gina case today is how much of a touchstone it's kind of become for a lot of African-American people in particular. There's a big rally planned for this weekend, and the chatter, even on places like Facebook and MySpace, is intense about this.
It has been incredible, and I'll tell you, down here in New Orleans, there are 6 separate groups that I know of that are organizing buses from down there. There's historically black colleges. There's people on the west bank of the Mississippi River. There's people from the poetry community. There's so many different organizations that have been going down there. It has really touched a nerve, and I think that what it really speaks to is not just what's happening in Gina, but what is happening in our criminal justice system and what is happening in the dialogue on race and the legacy of racism and white supremacy in this country.
Do you think that this particular case is egregious enough to warrant this, or is this just a movement that was looking for a kind of a catalyst and this case just happened to fit the bill?
You know, there's a few things about this case that make it really special. One is that image of those nooses hanging from a tree that really started this. And nooses, especially in small towns in the South, have a very specific meaning that really strikes a very serious nerve for people all around the country. So beginning with those nooses and the fact that no one in the school or in the district attorney's office seemed to take those nooses seriously. And I'm not saying necessarily that there needed to be even serious charges against the youth.
Because what happened was that the principal chose to not expel those students, even though that originally that's what the call was for. Those students were just suspended for a few days, right?
And even if they're just suspended, but the superintendent should have called all the students in and said, this is very serious, and we're going to talk about what these nooses mean. But they didn't even want to talk about them. They just dismissed them as nothing. And that, I think, is really where this began. And then the fact that just a couple of days, 2 days before the charges in question against the Gina 6, one of the members of the Gina 6 was again, it makes the disparate sentencing really clear. I mean, we've seen statistically all around this country we have a serious problem with disparate sentencing in our justice system. But in Gina, you just had this event 2 days before with the same youths involved, many of the same youths involved, with completely different charges, a different level of seriousness that's taken. So it's so plain the way it was presented in this case.
Jordan Flaherty, a writer and activist who will be in Gina, Louisiana this Saturday, part of this big rally. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Luke. And by the way, Left Turn magazine is a print publication as well.
Okay, great. Check it out, leftturn.org. You know, interestingly, Allison, I talked to a couple Gina residents on the phone today who said they think the city's getting a bad rap.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't come on the show and explain exactly why. So I guess the problem persists.
Al Sharpton's headed to town. I'm sure we'll be talking about this later in the week. Hey, August 1st, this was the big story of the day. A bridge in Minneapolis collapsed. It would take weeks before all the bodies were found. Stories off the front pages, but the fight for funding and repairs continues. We will catch up.
On the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart, everybody.
I'm Luke Burbank. Well, it's been a little over a month since that big bridge collapse in Minnesota that killed 13 people. And this is one of those stories that you hear a ton about. Our own Rachel Martin was dispatched to the scene by NPR. And then, you know, the sort of time moves on and then you never hear about it again. We aim to fix that here at the BPP. So on the line, we've got Jim Foti. He writes the blog Road Guy for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and he's the transportation reporter for the paper. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
So something like 140,000 people used this bridge every day, I've read. What has the effect been on the commute there without this bridge?
It hasn't been as bad as everyone expected. We got some federal money to increase some transit options from the park and rides. They widened a nearby freeway to handle some of the traffic. And commuters have been very creative about getting where they need to go. Rush hour starts earlier now. It goes later now. We interviewed some people who they stay later at the gym in downtown Minneapolis. They go work out after work, and then they drive home so they can avoid the rush. So people are still getting around, but there's been an incremental increase over time. People get more confident. They think, I could probably go this way now. And the neighborhoods near the collapse site are particularly congested.
Well, if they could actually kind of get around this bridge by more people taking public transport and staying at the gym, why do they need to rebuild this thing?
The state has done an economic impact estimate of the bridge's absence, and they have said that $400,000 a day in transportation costs alone are being spent by people going out of their way, taking longer to get places, things like that. And so the state is really pushing for a new bridge. And again, it's one of those things where people can make an accommodation for a while, but, you know, we're seeing the fatigue of,
right,
of patients, you know, erode. And again, the neighborhoods near the bridge are particularly hard hit. The freeway system's actually been all right.
Are they just burning the candle at both ends on this construction project?
Yeah, I talked to I met with the bridge team on Thursday, the top seven people who are working on it, and they're working 12 to 15 hours a day on the proposal. They had been. We're going to find out Wednesday who's going to build the new bridge. So, but we won't know the design.
Do they have any sense for when it would be fixed?
Yeah, it's going to be one of the faster major public works projects people have seen in a long time. They said sometime between September 15th next year and December 24th next year. Those are the project dates. So.
And in terms of cost, I mean, is anyone even floating a number for how much?
There is a budget. Minnesota received a $250 million. There's some wiggle room there because we got some money for transit and stuff. So the project is supposed to be between about $220 and $270. And most of the money is almost entirely federal money. We're going to have to come up with a little money of our own because they only give you money to replace what was there. And if you want to do any enhancements, and Minnesota has decided they want to make the bridge ready for light rail transit. And so we're going to have to come up with that money ourselves.
Hey, Jim, you drive around Minneapolis, and is it just kind of still sobering every time you pass a road that leads to this where this bridge was?
It's very weird. You know, you pass a sign that says, you know, 35W road closed ahead, and that's like the understatement of the year. The road is absolutely completely gone. They have all these barricades to keep people from going there. So, yeah, it is. I work with a woman who did tons and tons of coverage on the bridge stuff, and she used to take the bridge home every day. And I think it was the end of last week or the week before that, she was heading home and wasn't even thinking and just drove toward the bridge as though it were still there. You know, you don't realize how embedded in your life, you know, aspects of the landscape are, and when one just vanishes, it's pretty disorienting.
Yeah, we are definitely creatures of habit. Jim Foti writes the blog Road Guy for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and is the transportation reporter for the paper. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Well, it seems like things were going in the right direction in terms of repair and money. The Senate last week gave okay for $1 billion for bridge repair around the country, and that sounds like a lot until you realize the Department of Transportation says $65 billion is what's needed to get rid of the backlog of bridge repairs. And then there's how do we get the cash for this part of the story? Jerry Balanson is the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics magazine. He talked to us back when the story first broke. Hey, Jerry.
Hi. Well, first of all, thanks for the promotion. I'm actually the deputy editor of the magazine.
Oh, okay.
My boss hasn't heard yet.
Didn't you get the email? We just declared you editor.
We bestowed it upon you.
We have that power legally.
Excellent.
Jerry, what does $1 billion in repairs get you these days in terms of bridge repair?
Well, it depends. You know, the Minneapolis bridge, just a year ago, they were looking at sort of $2 million costs for some projects, and that was deemed kind of a lot of money. And right now, that seems kind of absurd compared to the $250 or $300 million it will cost to replace that bridge. So, you know, $1 billion, you know, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, and, you know, pretty soon you're, you know, talking about real money. But the backlog really is fairly immense. I was just talking to a colleague who got back from D.C. where they were, you know, she was looking at a bridge that the Woodrow Wilson bridge replacement, and that was a new bridge. The total cost for the roads, you know, leading up to it and the bridge itself was $2.5 billion. So, you know, these things can, you know, be quite expensive.
Let's talk about that backlog. Why is there such a backlog? Is it a matter of these bridges weren't maintained?
I think it's largely maintenance, yeah. They haven't been maintained properly. And the other thing is we just have an awful lot of bridges in the country, and an awful lot of them were built 50 years ago, and they're designed to last for 50 years. So to some extent, we just have this really big, you know, built-in system of roads and bridges, and it just takes a lot of money to maintain them. And it's not very sexy. I mean, people, you know, we find a lot of other things to spend our money on in the country other than this kind of stuff.
In the past, where has the money come from to maintain the bridges, or is that the problem? There hasn't been money to do it.
Well, a lot of different places. There's a lot of federal funding. This is certainly not the first transportation, you know, bill. And then there, you know, some of it comes from gas taxes, and there's a lot of, you know, local and state money too, you know, everything from bonds to just general revenues coming out of local and state budgets. I think a lot of the difficulty is how the money gets spent and who spends it. You know, there are kind of two ways to look at this. I'm not really a public policy expert quite this way, but the federal government can mandate specific projects, but they actually don't control most of the highways and bridges in the country. I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of different agencies on every level of government that control our highways. So sometimes the process of just getting approvals and you know, working things through the local system, it's really tedious and can take literally decades.
One of the things we should note is the president said he may veto the Senate's proposal because it exceeds the amount that he allocated. And he's saying tax increases to raise this money, that's just a non-starter. So where does this leave the funding for repairing of bridges? I mean, really, what's next?
Well, this was the Senate bill, and, you know, a bill was already passed in the House, so they have to, you know, go into committee and kind of iron out the difference and then submit, you know, the final act for signature or veto. You know, there are one of the things that people look at in some of these bills is some of the wasted money. Senator Tom Coburn, Oklahoma, you know, went through looking at some of the things that were included in the transportation bill, and there is an international peace garden in Duluth, Minnesota, that was $500,000. And, you know, I think we do need to shore up relations with the Canadians, but, you know, maybe that didn't belong in the transportation bill.
So people are going through and looking for the pork. They're looking for those sweetheart deals and maybe saying, hey, let's put this money actually towards something that could save lives.
There is that. I mean, I feel that you have to kind of, and certainly, you know, spending money better is something we should do, and is smart. He says that he's found, well, $2 billion in this bill and maybe $8 billion of the total that the Department of Transportation will spend next year that are pork projects, which doesn't completely really change the overall equation that much. Even if all that was taken out, it's not like we would suddenly then have all the money that we need to repair bridges. But I think there's also, you know, a lot to be said for how on the local level money is allocated, and I think that has to be looked at very carefully. I mean, historically there's been you know, a fair amount of money diverted from things like road maintenance and bridges into other capital projects that are, you know, commercial redevelopment zones, and yeah, there's a proposal, and I'm not sure of the status of this right now, so I shouldn't talk too much about it, but for, you know, $1 billion project in New Orleans, not to repair levees, but to bring back the waterfront with commercial development and lure tourism and so on. And some of this, you know, comes out of the same pool that, you know, people think are going for things like levees and transportation and so on. So it gets quite complex once the money starts getting spent.
Jerry Balanson from Popular Mechanics Magazine, nice to have you on the show again.
All right, thank you.
Here's an update from this weekend in Los Angeles County. In Harbor Gateway, a Latino youth, 17 years old, was shot on Western Avenue. He was transported to Harbor UCLA Medical Center, where he died. In Willowbrook, a Latino youth died at a hospital after being shot at about 1:42 a.m. Sunday morning in the 2400 block of Orris Street. In Lancaster, a black man was shot and killed in the 1400 block of West Jackman Street at about 3 a.m. on Saturday. He died at the scene. On average, there are about 100 of these murders in L.A. County every month, and the victims tend to be poor or gang members or both, and their deaths are not really big news stories. They are, however, a big deal to L.A. Times reporter Jill Leovi, who since January has been keeping track of every homicide in the county for the paper's blog, which is called The Homicide Report. Jill Leovi joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
How did this get started?
You know, it evolved. We were looking at different ways to have a crime page on the web, and I looked at a couple different models and finally rejected them and ended up narrowing it down to what I think we thought at the beginning was going to be a not very ambitious effort to just list the names of homicide victims in L.A. County and see what happened from there. And it's sort of grown out of that.
I mean, you were a homicide reporter before this, I understand. And was it just your frustration with only being able to write about, you know, one out of every 100 that happened?
The frustration of leaving the homicides uncovered is something that I and other reporters at the LA Times have lived with for a long time. And I've tried to cover the statistical story of homicide in various different ways. It's interesting. About a year before this project, I kind of went the other direction. I did a 200 or 300 inch, several page double truck news story just on one homicide, and you try to talk about the statistics in those stories, but this is another way of presenting them to the reader.
You actually, in speaking of statistics and, I guess, information, you put in race in this. Has that been a controversial thing to include?
You know, it was at first. It's interesting. One of the things that was sort of unexpected about the homicide report is the public response to it. There's a enormous and active commenting community. In fact, I came in this morning with a sense of dread because I'm about 150 comments behind, even though I try every day to keep up with them. And at first, that was very, very controversial, and there were a lot of complaints. Now it's interesting. The readers don't say much about it, and if somebody does come post on the site about it, before I can even respond or put something up on the blog, usually a bunch of other readers will jump in and say, hey, this is the reason the homicide report puts race on. It's become, I think, much more accepted among our readers.
One of the things I think sort of interesting is regarding the comments section, aside from race, there seems to be, at least in this one that I'm on now, a big discussion about immigration and illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
That seems to be another touchstone.
Immigration people will tend to take over every commenting venue on LATimes.com. There's a newspaper reporter. There are certain issues that that inflame readers, and in L.A., immigration is certainly one. But we make a little bit of an effort to edit for relevance sometimes. So sometimes those discussions can absolutely take over. And there are other places on LATimes.com where immigration is being discussed. So
this is a really – I mean, I just – if anyone hasn't seen this yet, I would say definitely go to the LA Times or go to our website, npr.org/Bryant Park, which we're going to link to this, because it's so kind of simple – in the writing, and yet it tells you so much. And just to see this kind of aggregated this way is just really – I lived in L.A. for years and in a kind of rough neighborhood, and I had a sense for this stuff. But till you see just this list of people and you read little details about them. And in fact, one of the ones that really jumped out at me was a guy, 23-year-old Walter Hernandez. He was killed last week in broad daylight south of downtown L.A. And here's what you wrote that really kind of struck me. You said he was well-liked and well-respected within his large and active gang, according to police. And then you write, why does this matter? Well, because it makes it more likely that Hernandez's friends will seek revenge. One death like this can swiftly become many. What have you learned about the sort of violent crime in Los Angeles County from doing this blog?
Well, you know, violent crime in Los Angeles County is really just a microcosm of violent crime in America. We do not actually have any kind of special homicide problem. We do have an urban homicide problem, but it's very likely comparable to urban areas everywhere in the country. And, in fact, the overall homicide rate in Los Angeles does not stand out among major cities. What we really have is an American homicide problem. We have in this country homicide rates per 100,000, deaths per 100,000 per year that are just off the charts compared with other developed Western nations. And the homicide problem demographically in Los Angeles looks like it does elsewhere. Blacks, and particularly black men, are extremely high propensity victims, Latino men secondarily, and other groups sort of following behind that. It's interesting to see homicide in Los Angeles because, as you know from living here, this is a Latino city. This is a city that's at least 50% and probably much more people of Latin American extraction. And blacks in L.A. City are only about 9% of the population, and yet they're consistently a third, sometimes even a half of all homicide victims, very, very disproportionate. And that's true nationally, too. So really what you see in seeing Los Angeles homicides is the national homicide problem, I think. And that's one of the gratifying things about showing this to readers. The problem is an adult problem. It's not a youth problem particularly. I think about 10% of victims are under 18. It is a problem of male fighting violence, men versus men, usually men who look demographically similar to each other. And it's concentrated along the margins of society, of course. People with criminal backgrounds are very, very likely to be homicide victims.
Jill, one thing I noticed on your blog, you also give phone numbers of various detectives who are working the cases. Do you know if your blog has led to any tips that have solved any cases?
Oh, I don't think it has. Maybe a few. You hear it now and then. I think that the detectives do learn about their victims from the blog. I hear that. There's, you know, friends and family members crop up on the blog that don't necessarily crop up when the victims are killed. And one of the principles of solving these homicides is understanding who the victims were and who they associated with. So I'm not sure as an investigative tool that the blog has been very important. The detectives, I find, are for the most part very cooperative, though. I think they just think of these victims as deserving some recognition, and they're tired of these homicides being ignored.
Well, that's the thing I was wondering about. You must have family members of victims. They must very carefully watch the blog, because for a lot of them, this is the only place where there will be any mention of the fact that this person was killed. I understand you're, after this interview, going to a funeral.
Yeah, I may not make it at this point, but I was going to try to stop in on a funeral from a homicide I had from last week.
Do the families reach out to you? I mean, they invited you to this funeral?
You know, I contacted this family and talked to them about going to the funeral. It's funny, I had an interesting week last week. The style that I write the homicide report, I guess, can be a little bit impersonal, and people are not exactly clear on what it is. They're not clear that it's just me doing it. And I had two families last week for some reason turn me down, and they told me that they'd already been covered, that the L.A. Times had already done a story on the victim and that I should go read the L.A. Times. And I asked them what they meant, and they said the obituary page online, you know, that the L.A. Times does. And I realized they were talking, actually, about my blog.
Oh.
People go tell me to read what those people have written.
Do you feel a sense of personal responsibility that somebody's got to keep track of this stuff?
Yeah, I do. I mean, on just a practical level, I want this to be a really good database by the end of the year for myself, if nothing else. You know, I've struggled with data for a long time covering homicide. It's hard to get good real-time data that's local. I'm going to have what I need. I'm going to have what I need on these cases by the end of the year, and it needs to be comprehensive. I'm actually quite far behind. The homicide report is missing probably 68 to 70 cases right now.
Wow. Well, I understand that when you went on vacation, you lost some ground, so I guess it's going to be a while before you can do that again.
Yeah. I've got the names up there now.
Well, thank you for telling us about it. Thanks for doing your work. That's Jill Leovi. She's a crime reporter for the LA Times. She chronicles LA homicides, each and every one that occurs in the county, at the LA Homicide Report on the Times website. You can also check it out on our site, npr.org/Bryant Park.
Coming up with the program, that guy who counted to a million. Well, now he's got time to talk to us here on NPR News coming up. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. And you know what? We are always available to you online at npr.org/Bryant Park. That's my promise. Mm-hmm. I'm Allison Stewart.
Yeah, we're going to put your number up there, your home number. That should go well. I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up.
I got enough troubles, pal.
I'm sure Bill will talk to them. Just call and ask about.
Just call up and say, do you like the Cardinals?
Exactly.
And then put the phone down for an hour and a half.
Coming up, the secret is out, or the cat's out of the bag, or the chicken strip is out of the hen house. I don't know, something. A Philadelphia food critic named Craig LeBan, everyone knows what he looks like because he's being sued over a bad review he gave. We're going to talk to him and find out if he can still do his job. First, though, we want to hear about today's top stories from our own newscaster, Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, everyone. So it seems software giant Microsoft is taking some heat for not playing fair with others. That's according to a ruling from a European court today looking at Microsoft's alleged antitrust practices. The company has lost its appeal of an EU court order that said Microsoft was abusing its dominance in the market. Under that 2004 ruling, Microsoft was ordered to share its communications code with rivals. It has to sell a copy of the Windows operating system that doesn't include the media player, and it has to pay over $600 million in fines, the largest ever handed out by EU regulators. The court said the European Commission was right when it concluded that Microsoft was guilty of monopoly abuse. It also said regulators had clearly demonstrated that selling media software with Windows had undercut Microsoft's rivals. Microsoft can appeal the decision to the EU's highest court within 2 months. And some major political changes in Pakistan today. After serving as both the Pakistani president and chief of the army for the past 8 years, Pervez Musharraf has announced he'll hand in his general's uniform. Senior members of Musharraf's political party said today he plans to quit as army chief and serve instead as a civilian president. The move comes just weeks before Musharraf, a major U.S. ally, hopes to be reelected as the country's leader. Musharraf assumed military leadership after he seized political control of the country in a military coup in 1999. And glitz, glamour, and the occasional bleeped curse word colored last night's Emmy Awards. Early in the show, comedian Ray Romano and actress Katherine Heigl were both cut off when they apparently used some choice four-letter words on stage. According to reports, the performers suddenly vanished from stage and were replaced by static pictures of the auditorium. The program was on time delay, which allows networks to edit live shows. And actress Sally Field, no stranger to controversial acceptance speeches, got her own bleep. Field won the Emmy for her role on the show Brothers and Sisters, and during her speech, she used some tough language to criticize the war in Iraq. According to the Associated Press, she said, quote, "If mothers ruled the world, there would be no blankety-blank wars in the first place." And amidst all the bleeping hubbub, there were some awards doled out.
And the Emmy goes to...
That's actress Helen Mirren announcing the win for Best Dramatic Series, a fitting tribute to The Sopranos, which this year ended its sixth-season run on HBO. I'm Rachel Martin. The news is always online at NPR.org. Luke and Allison, back to you.
Thank you, Rachel Martin.
You could knock me over with a wet spaghetti noodle. The Sopranos wins, huh?
I know, but Gandolfini lost.
There was a photo, I think, on the cover of The Times today.
James Spader.
Where he was standing in the back when the whole show won, and he looked kind of angry.
Maybe.
He looked a little scary. Well, speaking of food, if you were casually reading the food section of the Philadelphia Inquirer back in March of 2007, you could have very easily missed it. It was a short, straightforward review, not really a nice one, but of a suburban Philadelphia restaurant called Chops. Craig LeBan wrote that the overall meal was, quote, expensive and disappointing, from the soggy and sour chopped salad to a miserably tough and fatty strip steak.
I'm not going there.
Well, the drama that one little review created has sort of roiled on in the aftermath. Dan Gross is a Philadelphia Daily News gossip columnist. He broke the story we're about to hear more from. He joins us now. Okay, Greg LeBan, influential food critic for The Inquirer. He doesn't like the miserably tough and fatty strip steak. The paper runs the review. What happened next?
What happened next was, according to the lawsuit filed by the owner of Chops, he contacted Craig LeBan, told him that he thought there was some mistake because he didn't believe that he had the dish in question. And according to the lawsuit, LeBan seemingly acknowledged some sort of mistake but would not print a correction, invited this Mr. Plotkin, the owner of Chops, on to an online forum where they could discuss it, but Alex Plotkin didn't think that was good enough and basically brought on a lawsuit against the Philadelphia Inquirer and against Craig Laban over not apparently over whether he liked the meal or didn't, but apparently Laban ate a different dish than what he claims that he ate. And, you know, I guess Alex figures if you're going to insult my steak, at least insult the right thing.
Right. So it was actually a different – it wasn't a strip steak. It was – I thought I read a steak sandwich that he had without the bread or something.
That's what's in the suit. And I know – I think since then it's been described as some other kind of steak. So now, you know, I don't really even know at this point because it's been described so many ways.
It's your definition of what steak is.
Yeah. I suppose so.
So it depends on the meaning of steak, right? what's the status of the lawsuit at this point?
At this point, my understanding is simply that the lawsuit, you know, is still in the court system and has yet to be settled. I'm also of the impression, I'm actually somewhat surprised that it has not been settled, because I am of the belief that Chops is not particularly seeking, you know, financial compensation as much as they are seeking, you know, Laban to sort of admit that he messed up.
Yeah, I was actually wondering, this is my last question, but I'll jump to it. I'll move it up in the order. This seems like it's whatever Chop is trying to accomplish by this is not being accomplished, because here we are, you know, months later talking about this mysterious piece of meat. Isn't this worse press for them?
I think that Alex Plotkin definitely realizes that he might have shot himself in the foot with this suit. And I'm of the impression that he wants to just kind of get the whole thing behind him as soon as he can. I know that the restaurant has gotten, you know, people have called and like heckled him over the phone and stuff like that. I mean, they do great business. I don't think that business has necessarily dropped off or picked up one way or the other in regards to the suit. But I do feel as though he definitely seems to think that it's more trouble than it's worth. And my info suggests that he sort of just wants to walk away at this point.
What kind of influence does a Craig Laban review in the Philadelphia Inquirer carry? Could this be the end of the line for a restaurant potentially?
I mean, it theoretically it could, and I know that there have been people, especially like small restaurant owners in the past, who have suggested, you know, that he, you know, this one bad review would essentially ruin the restaurant. This place, Chops, though, is regularly packed with, you know, lunch and dinner crowd, and I think it had been around for at least 2, maybe 3 years prior to Laban running this review. So like I said before, I don't really see any kind of permanent harm done by this review. But as a rule, I mean, you know, Craig Laban is definitely, I would say, the Philadelphia authority on restaurants. And his reviews do get read very well, and they do get taken very seriously.
Have you eaten at Chops?
I have.
How is it?
It's fine with me. I'm not a food critic, and I don't particularly have a sophisticated palate, but it's, you know, it's a steakhouse. They got good food, good drinks. It had never occurred to me that it was miserable or anything like that.
All right, Dan Gross, Philadelphia Daily News gossip columnist. Thank you very much for filling us in on this.
Okay. Thank you.
First of all, if you've got the time to call a restaurant and heckle it about a review,
yeah,
you need to find something else to do with your time.
Absolutely.
That's my takeaway from that part of it. But you know what? The man at the center of this entire controversy is joining us now. Craig Laban joins us from Philadelphia, right, Craig?
Hello. Hi, I'm here.
Hi. I know you can't really talk about the lawsuit.
That's why we had that other guy on.
There's a lawsuit going on. But there's another chapter to the story. It takes this other whole turn that Philadelphia Magazine ran a photo of you in covering the lawsuit. Now, throughout your career, you'd gone to great lengths for people not to know what you look like. Can you describe some of the things you've done to make sure people don't know who you are?
Well, you know, people always describe it as great lengths, but I don't really perceive it that way. You know, this is a pretty standard approach to being a restaurant critic in a major city. You know, you do your best to remain as anonymous as possible. And to be honest, I've never really elaborated on what it is I did or didn't do. So,
I mean, but are we talking wigs? Are we talking wigs? Are we talking?
Well, over the course of 10 years, there may have been a wig or two. But to be honest, you know, as far as, you know, fake beards and stuff, I never found an adhesive that could last through dessert. So, I would say that I don't go to some of the links that have been made, you know, made legend in various biographies that are out there.
So what was your reaction when you found out that your picture had been published and that you had been outed?
Well, it's an odd sensation. I can't recommend it for people. But, you know, no columnist should really expect to be treated with kid gloves by a competing magazine when you're being written about. But I do think that even this was even considered a cheap shot, you know, at the competition, even by Philly Magazine standards. So It was surprising, you know, but especially since, you know, just 6 months prior to this article, the editor of Philadelphia Magazine had taken me out to lunch and said how great I was and how much he respected me and asked me to come work for the magazine.
Plot thickens. Was that Larry Platt?
Yeah, sure. Larry took me out to lunch and said how much he respected what I did. And then 6 months later, writes that, you know, I'm obviously too self-important, so they have to put my picture in the article. You know, and the thing about it is the article was, you know, purports to be about a libel suit. But really, they sort of make the issue, you know, my identity. And I think that was a bit of a sensationalist approach. And it's not really consistent even with the way the magazine has handled treating my anonymity in the past. I mean, they wrote a whole feature story about me 3 years ago and didn't publish my picture. So I think there's a double standard, and the lack of consistency has called into question, I think, some of the motivations.
Well, Larry Platt appeared on the NPR show On the Media about 2 weeks ago. He's the editor of Philadelphia Magazine, justifying the decision to print your picture. He did this to host Bob Garfield. Let's listen.
He's not really anonymous to begin with, by his own admission. Most of the restaurateurs in Philadelphia have posted in their kitchens photos of him. Media insiders like myself know what he looks like. The only group that doesn't know what he looks like are the readers and the diners. And we have always extended the courtesy to Craig, as to other reviewers, of maintaining anonymity. But something changed, and that was he became part of a news story, and we show the protagonists in our news stories.
Do you buy that?
No.
Why did I know you were going to say that?
You know, like I said, you know, if you here I'm part of a news story today, but 3 years ago I was the center of a large feature, and they chose not to put my picture in there. And there's a certain inconsistency now. I mean, he does make some points that I will agree with. I mean, the picture they put in their magazine is an old picture. There are lots of pictures flying around about me. Any major critic is going to start having pictures appear within days, if not months, of the time that they take the job. And it's just one of the obstacles that realistically every reviewer is going to have to deal with. But whether or not that means you're identified every time you walk into a restaurant, that's absolutely not true.
Craig Leban of the Philadelphia Inquirer, the restaurant reviewer. Go forth and review. Keep us safe from bad, some kind of steaks.
I got a tip on the Wendy's on Ripley off of Tomlinson Road. They don't have your photo up yet.
Okay, well, so I'm heading there. Now I know what to eat for lunch.
<All right. laughs>
Craig, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there was this guy with a webcam who decided to count to a million. Remember this?
999,998.
So why'd he do that, you may ask? OCD may play a role. I'm not sure. But actually, Jeremy Harper locked himself in an apartment for about 3 months, found out that's the time it takes to count to 1 million. He did it to raise money for a charity that helps people with disabilities. Now, he finished up last Friday. You remember we dipped in and out during our live webcast earlier that day? Well, now that he's finished, he's got some time to talk to us. Hi, Jeremy.
How are you doing?
That's my question for you. How are you doing?
I'm still in shock. I've been walking around in my apartment.
Wait, get out of your apartment, bro. You were there for a month and a half.
Yeah, I've been out over the weekend, but you know, I'm in here and the cameras are off, but they're still set up, and I find myself narrating a little bit, you know, what I'm doing, changing camera angles and stuff like that when I shouldn't be.
How'd you feel when you actually reached 1 million?
It's kind of funny, you know, this whole time I felt like I've been in a power position. That sounds kind of crazy, but I've always known kind of just what to say or what to do. But at that moment, I just kind of lost all control. And, you know, I said the number, and then it was just like a big bubble just kind of just popping on me at one time. I just said it and went with it. You know, it was a weird emotion.
Well, let's play. Apparently, it was pretty dramatic. I have not yet heard this. I will confess. I wanted to wait until the segment to hear a little bit. This is the moment when you reached 1 million.
999,998.
999,999. 1 million. We should point out that you broke out into a chicken dance. Is that right?
Oh, you know, there's so much story behind that.
I'm sure, you know what? I am sure there is. So people who are wondering, okay, this guy did this to raise money. How did you raise the money, actually, for charity?
Just donations. We put it out there, and it started as, hey, I'm just going to count and you guys donate. And we did a lot of other things. I had a sound blaster board where people could play sounds in my apartment. We did all kinds of different things. A lot of it was covering costs, but a lot of it was, you know, I think we ended up with, after what I sent in, what we got this weekend, close to $12,000 for Push America. So, you know, it's a nice chunk of change for them, but I think more for them. They're not the most prominent organization, you know, charitable organization out there. So the exposure that they've received from it is the accomplishment I feel from it.
And what's the name of it again?
Push America.
Push America.
Are you
okay.
just seeing numbers in your sleep? Like when you're in Vegas and you play too much blackjack, you close your eyes and you still see cards flipping. Is that you with numbers?
You know, most people ask that, you know, do you dream about numbers? And I really didn't. The cameras that were on the whole time, I think, are really what kept me sane through the whole thing. If I would have been locked in my apartment and counting to a million and nobody was watching, I would certainly have lost my mind. I would be, like, you know, just out of it. But there's a weird interaction, you know. When you know somebody's watching you do something, it gives you a level of the stage, you know. And I'm not just an idiot. I'm an entertainer for some some kind of way.
And your girlfriend's still with you, right?
Nope. She's finished up. She gave up about $700,000.
What?
Wow.
When are we getting a 3-hour show? We need the entire third hour for this.
Well, ladies,
have you gotten any other proposals?
Jeremy's single, so.
obviously there was more to it. that I don't want to talk about, but. It was weird timing. It was odd to do that kind of like personal stuff on the internet too.
Oh, I'm sure.
But
I do a lot of personal
stuff.
Well,
Jeremy, we wish you the best of luck and congratulations for hitting a million.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It's been a ride.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.